When I was going through this week, I thought, you know, I see this book and I say, man, where do we start? So what I want to do before we even move further, I was noticing that's a nice book you have there, Joel. Frank has a nice one. And so I want to encourage you all to read, especially the little ones, read them from the beginning through, because we're going to pick and choose some areas to read in here that are that basically we can't go through every last word. But there's a few things I wanted to read today. And I'm actually going to have Rebens and Stacy read this. Can you read this? And this is from like the prior to, this is like the, I guess they would call the part of the overview. And this portion is called Three Areas of Life. And the idea is taken from Proverbs chapter 6, verse 23. It says, for a commandment is a lamp, and Torah is light, and the way of life is remonstrance of reproof. Let me go ahead and read this, if you would. It's going to go from here, and you can stop right there if you would.
This verse contains a thumbnail description of the three parts of the Torah. Mitzvah, the physical performance of the commandments, is like a lamp. It is a receptacle that contains oil and wick, or electricity, filament, and provides light. So too, one uses hands to affix a mezuzah, feet to rush to the synagogue, wealth to contribute to charity, like a lamp that uses physical items to provide and sustain light. The body and the appurtenances of the world combine to do God's will in a tangible way. But once the oil is consumed and the wick is spent, the lamp is still and dark. Its light is never more than temporary. Even the longest-lasting fluorescent bulb will burn out eventually, and the glow of a mitzvah fades away. The Torah, however, is different in a basic way. Its light is spiritual. It unites its students with the sources or source of all wisdom. Just as his wisdom is timeless, so the Torah is timeless, and its spiritual capital permanent. Then there is the third component of our faith. The way of life is the remonstrance of reproof. The sages derive from this phrase that man earns his share of the world to come only through hard work and suffering. Berakos 5a. The way of life in this world is the highway to the world to come. It is traversed only with difficulty, because the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant, especially for people foolish enough to resent criticism. But intelligent people welcome it, relish it, thrive on it. To aspire to the world to come without recognizing the need for guidance and criticism is like a diamond miner who refuses to dig. Of course, there is a price to pay, but man has no greater bargain.
I want to read a quick definition to you of this word that has come up a couple times, remonstrance. Anybody have an idea what that means? Yeah, it's kind of one of those words that they use specifically to try to describe something. Well, what is it? So a forcefully reproachful protest. Angry remonstrances in the Senate. He shut his ears to any remonstrance. It has here the remonstrance, a document drawn up in 1610 by the Arminians of the Dutch Reformed Church, representing the differences between their doctrines and those of strict Calvinists. So this idea, I think, can be, you just read in here about the people. Here we go. The way of life in this world is the highway of the world to come. It is traversed only with difficulty because of the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant. especially for people foolish enough to resent criticism. How many of you like to be criticized? It's how you learn. How, but do you like it? Do you choose to like it?
You know, there are some people in this world. Let me
give you a what you're going to say is going to be worth recording, so.
Yes, I enjoy constructive criticism.
Yes.
I think that's the important distinction, because there are some individuals who are just constantly complaining. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's too warm, it's too soft, whatever.
Yeah.
But if it's constructive criticism that you can build upon and better the situation or learn something, then by all means, bring it on.
But that whole idea, the reason it says here, foolish people, let's see, it is traversed only with difficulty because the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant. So that's what I'm getting. Who likes an unpleasant criticism? Nobody. Go ahead.
But if it's coached in truth,
yes,
then you might not like it, but you've learned from it.
Well, okay, but that's the point we're getting to. And if it's done kindly. So here's the idea. The idea behind this has to do with you have to make a decision to say, you know what? It may be unpleasant, but I'm not going to be foolish enough not to receive it.
You're right, but I would push it further. I guess it depends on how the person who is doing the criticism, if they're doing it in a kindly fashion,
right,
or if they're just, tearing your face off on purpose.
So that's a good point. So then let me ask you this. That's another part of this. So then if they are doing it that way, but with the critique is still good and right, then should you receive it?
Oh, of course.
See, so there you go. So then you get to this idea of you have to make a choice, no matter how it's presented, to receive it. And we hope that it wouldn't be presented in a harsh way that makes it unpleasant.
Yeah. And we've all said things that we wish we could take back. And if it is said in a harsh way, you just have to shrug your shoulders and feel a little sorry for the other individual. But we've all been there.
Oh, absolutely. And the idea of, again, it keeps coming back to this idea of, when they say here, this is talking about life, it's traversed only with difficulty because of the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant. So the criticism is often unpleasant. Yeah.
Well, that's why you usually hire an attorney, because they're trained at saying things in an objective, unemotional way.
Yes. But just in everyday life. So in everyday life, to give an example, you're somewhere, you're at work, and the boss, you've done something wrong for the umpteenth time, and they're a little short on the sugar, and they come to you and, hey, I've told you over it, quit doing it, And you know it, what they're saying is right. So this is the idea. The idea is that foolish people, or don't be foolish enough to resent it. Partially, this idea has come up right here of how it's packaged or how it's presented. And they even say, and even right at the beginning, he said, because why is the journey difficult? Because the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant. So it's difficult, especially for people foolish enough to resent the criticism. So you have something that comes, this criticism comes in a way that's difficult often to receive. Will you be foolish enough to just not receive it because it's unpleasant? This is kind of what they're getting at. What Frank was saying is true from our side. We definitely want to do things and talk to people and do things in a way that doesn't, especially when we know it can be unpleasant. Then it's kind of like, I remember growing up, and we would stand in line and we would all get a spoonful of cod liver oil. But then we'd also get a teaspoonful right after of sugar. So we knew that if we endured the unpleasant part, that there was something sweet behind it. But we couldn't get away from, we can't always get away from the unpleasant. But even if we didn't take the sugar with the after, if we didn't receive any sugar, should we continue to take the cod liver oil?
Yes.
Yeah. But who is that on? According to what they're saying, who's that on? It's on the person who's on the receiving end of it.
Right.
Yep. And you can define this. Can you have the mic to Casey too? He's got a quick comment. Oh, never mind. He's got a mic. But this idea, I think a way of kind of giving a word to this or a phrase would be biblical maturity or even just natural maturity. And it's not always easy. Yeah, go ahead, Case.
So this just mainly focuses on the response. It's not on the actions of the person giving the criticism.
I mean, that's kind of the And the idea is that, the whole focus of it is, why is life difficult? Because of this reproof, this remonstrance that's often unpleasant, and it's especially unpleasant for people foolish enough to resent criticism. So if you resent criticism, okay, well, you got a big problem right there. I mean, you're not, just like you're saying, you're never going to learn. And, you know, part of criticism and part of receiving it is when you, part of what they call it, stage fright, is exactly that. What are they going to say about me? What if I make a mistake? One thing that's helped me is that I make a lot of mistakes, and that's okay. If there's anybody here who doesn't, but it's usually the ones who think they never make mistakes who are the ones to bring the criticism in a way that is not meant to help, but it's meant to
tear down,
scold. We were at the Gideon's dinner that we're invited to. It was they called it a pastor appreciation dinner. And the guest speaker said something. I said, no. I just sat there and said, no. And he is a worldwide public figure who's going from spot to spot all over the world giving the same message. And I said, Lord, I can't just walk out of here and leave here and not say, pull him aside and say something to him. So, I'm the only one in the kippah, and everyone's, they call me rabbi, and people kind of look because, oh, pastor such, and So you feel different already. And I said, Lord, if I don't say anything to him, none of these pastors even caught any of this, and they really have no reason to. And let me do my little, throw in my couple shekels that'll maybe, be a mitzvah to the Gideons. And in my little way, maybe I can help them in something they didn't know. And so one of the elders there, I think you may have gone to talk to him, say, hey, can you, someone, I remember who it was, I said, I'd like to talk to, is he still here? And so they rounded him up, and they said, well, come with us, and they kind of brought us together, and he looked at me, and I got my kippah on, and he's kind of, and I said, how are you doing? And first, again, no matter how I was going to say what I was going to say, there was going to be a little bit of unpleasant. But I made sure the two of us were alone. It wasn't just, I didn't go on and go up to the microphone, excuse me, everyone, I want to correct the keynote speaker. No, I made sure we were alone. I said, and I start off, I gave him first a spoonful of sugar. And he didn't know why. And I said, hey, I just want, I'm such and such, interesting. I really enjoy the things you had to say and your passion. And where are you headed from here? Oh, I'm going to Asia to speak, and I was just over here to speak. Wonderful. Hey, I want to mention something to you that you said, and I'm not at peace leaving here without just mentioning something to you that maybe you're not aware of. And so at that point, he looked at me and said, what did I say? And I said, well, you said that Jesus went and he spoke in synagogues and he spoke in temples. Okay, yeah, did I say that? Okay, yeah. And, well, he didn't speak in temples. He spoke in the holy place of God, the temple of God in the outer courts, around the temple. You say temples, or did he go speak with the Buddhists? Are you saying that he went to Salt Lake City? Well, you need to be careful about that, what you're saying that he did. And I said, it was very great that you recognize that he spoke in temple or in synagogues because he was Jewish, but he spoke in the temple of God, the holiest place on earth. Underneath is the cornerstone of the whole universe where everything was formed from, right there. That's where he spoke. And he kind of looked and he was like, whoa, I didn't recognize that. So I said, hey, God bless you. I enjoyed, you know, Shabbat Shalom. And I kind of shook his hand and went on about my way. But I could tell he got it. Did he mean something bad by that? No, he just didn't know what he was saying. I was like, oh my God, I can't let this. And if I wouldn't have said something, then it would have been on me. Because nobody else, who's going to go and tell him that? Nobody. And so this whole idea, the way of life in this world is the highway to the world to come. It is traversed only with difficulty because the remonstrance of reproof is often unpleasant, especially for people foolish enough to resent criticism. In yeshiva every week, I go in and, you know, when I first started, I was very careful about what I said because I wanted to make sure what I said was, hello, Shabbat Shalom, absolutely, absolutely, good morning. And so we're going through Perkei Avot right now, brother. If you, we'll have it on the screen. We're just having a discussion. You're welcome to join in. Absolutely, we're glad you're here. And so I was mentioning the class. And so I was very careful. I said that, oh, yes, yes, that's true, wonderful. As time has progressed, and Rabbi Bernstein may say something, well, Rabbi Bernstein, you know, blah, 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 and I just talk and I don't think about it. To the point where he says, you know what, Brent? A couple weeks, he said, you know what, Brent? You're right, but the word you're saying is not right. But I understand what you're trying to say and why. So let me correct you. Let me help you. And this is 60 people in there. Did I feel like, oh my gosh, he's going to correct me and I'm going to? No, I didn't feel like that at all. Where's my? No, I was happy when he did it. And everyone who was there benefited from it because they used the same. You can get stuck on certain words that you don't, you're trying to convey an idea or a thought with that you don't realize you need a better word to do it. That makes sense? This whole book, Perkei Avot, again, it's the first book of the, we talked about last week. Yeah, it's in six sections. This is the first tractate of the Mishnah in six sections. And this by no way, someone say no way, replaces Torah. We don't teach that. We don't believe that. If anyone ever says that to you, tell them that you don't know what you're talking about. And once you call someone who knows, they can tell you so they can help you understand. These are the fathers who got together and they said, how can we do this? How can we walk out this walk? How can we walk out Torah together? In particular, what's ethical? What is ethical treatment of? You know, do not steal. Okay, we get all that. We realize what that is. But how can I ethically live with people? We're not just living on based on don't steal and don't kill them. There's got to be more to life than that. How about treat them right? How about pray for them? How about do unto them that you would have them do unto you? What does that mean? Well, let's talk about that too. That's basically what this is. The ethics of how do we even live and walk through life? And in particular, this little section here is talking about criticism. If you want to read more about that, you can read in the book of Berakos 5a in the Talmud. Great discussion about this. So I just, as I was going through this morning and yes, you know, going through this, I said, let me read a few things from this overview just to give you an idea of the flavor of what's to come in here. That being said, we read through Mishnah 1 last time, and again, we can continue to, we can talk on Mishnah 1 forever. We're going to keep on moving through here. I want to read Mishnah 2, Shimon the Righteous. Yeah. Do you have that one handy in your thing there, Frank? Shimon the Righteous. Yep, that's it. Yep. Shimon Chatzadik was Kohen Gadol. Sure, absolutely.
In Hebrew, it's
right. It's the format is. Yeah, no, it took me a while to understand the flow of this one too, because it goes back and forth between a lot of different things. Yeah, go right ahead and read Mishnah number 2, if you would. And again, when we're reading this. This is a lifetime's worth of just studying and understanding. It's not, you're not going to leave here thinking, I know it all, or you're going to leave here with more questions and answers, but you're also going to leave with some understanding of a few key things and criticism.
Very
yeah.
Short. Only 2
go ahead and read it, and I'll keep on.
2 and 3?
No, just 2.
Simon the Just was one of the last survivors of the Great Assembly. He used to say, upon 3 things the world is based, upon the Torah, upon divine service, and upon the practice of charity.
There we go. Give me 1 second to actually find that in here, because I had a different section. What's that? Is that the second paragraph of 1? Okay, give me a second here. Yeah, we start the commentary so I can at least hear it.
Commentary on Simon the Just. Either Simon ben Onias the first, high priest from 310 to 291 BCE, or more probably his grandson, high priest from 219 to 199, Joshua ben Sira, the contemporary of the latter Simon, speaks of him as, quote, great among his brethren and the glory of his people. How glorious was he when he came out of the sanctuary, like the full moon on the feast days and like the rainbow becoming visible in the cloud, unquote. And apparently that's referenced in Ecclesiasticus 50.
Okay. Let me go ahead and pause here. I want to read something to you here. I'm just trying to see where I want to start, because I can read me that first portion again. That's a good about the 3 things that the world stands upon.
Simon the Just was one of the last survivors of the Great Assembly. He used to say, upon 3 things the world is based, upon the Torah, upon divine service, and upon the practice of charity.
Okay. So let's start with that. Let's just start and discuss these things. Torah. That was pretty easy to understand, that everything is based on Torah. The world, how we are to function in everything that we do. How are we to relate to God? Well, he tells us how we relate to one another. He tells us how. What's number 2?
Upon divine service. Would you like me to read the commentary on that?
On divine service?
Yes.
Sure, yep.
Because I was thinking to myself, all right, you need to explain that. Divine service. Originally, this meant the sacrificial cult of the temple, including the prayers.
I don't know why they use that word cult. But they don't mean what it means today.
Right.
So scratch the understanding of it, what it means today is not what it's talking about.
Including the prayers by which it was accompanied.
Yeah.
But the term soon came to mean service of God in the heart.
Yeah.
Worship for fundamental importance of prayer, man's response to God in Israel. See the introduction to this prayer book. Okay.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that? Because I can read, but I don't want to discuss. And that's why in this discussion, we're going to really just let it go where it goes, where there's questions and comments and thoughts. And another thing I want to mention to you, as we're reading through this, see this through the eyes of Messiah. Everything we do is through the lens with, for, by Yeshua, not separated from him. So when they're talking about divine service of the temple, we've been talking about that a whole lot. This idea that there's no temple now, so what can we do? Well, all we do are things to commemorate the sacrifices going on in the temple until the temple is reestablished. Go ahead. I don't want to lose your train of thought.
What I'm hearing in the commentary, as well as the actual words in the book, is a lot of the things that were said by James, by Timothy, by Peter, when they were writing their letters, includes this same thought.
Absolutely. It's Jewish thought that had existed for thousands of years. No matter when it was, you know, if all of a sudden today these things are written down, does that mean that they originated today?
No,
they were just written down today. So all of these things had been gone way back. And these were Jews who absolutely, they knew Talmud, they knew the mission, they knew the oral law that had been passed down. They couldn't operate without it. I was talking to someone, I don't want to get into a whole lot, but the idea, it's impossible to have just a law. The presence of a law implies there has to be an oral law, an oral interpretation of it. For instance, if you drive down the street here at 100 miles an hour, what are you doing?
Speeding,
which is doing what? Breaking, which law is it breaking? What's that? Well, the speed limit law, right? So if you go outside, I don't know, it's probably 40, 45, I'm not sure what it is. But say it's 45 and you're going 100. Well, you're grossly breaking that law. Okay, so we recognize there is a law on the books in place that says something to the effect of you need to drive up to the posted speed limit. Anything a tenth of a mile an hour over that is what? It's speeding. It's breaking the law, okay? So then, a policeman is right here in his motorcycle, and he sees you going by, and he clocks you at 100. So he knows you're breaking the law. But on that same day, he clocks you going 100. He pulls you over, and at that point, he really could, if he wanted to, he could arrest you for just reckless endangerment, reckless driving. You know, there's kids, there's a lady here in a wheelchair trying to cross the street, and you're going 100, depending on the circumstances. Okay. But if he's there also and he sees someone going 68, can he still pull them over? Did they still break the law?
Yes.
Can he go out and give them a ticket? Is he more likely to be more lenient with them than the person doing 100? Okay. Or retired. Or a rabbi, I'll put my kippah on and say, I'm sorry. So what am I trying to say? So all of these processes are going through the police officer's mind, right? Is that the law? Or is that the oral law, the oral tradition that the police have used to determine, well, when should we give a ticket? When should we arrest somebody? So with a law, you can't just have a law without some type of how do we do it together? How do we enforce this together? Does that make sense? Any thoughts on that? Now, when the police officer says, hey, you're going 100, that's grossly over. Is he adding to the law? No, he's interpreting the law that exists. So what if I said to you, well, you know, Linda, guess what? There's no such thing as the police officer interpreting what that law is. You'd say, well, what are you talking about? Then how's he supposed to do his job? No, Linda doesn't exist. It's just the law and that's it. Well, how's he supposed to do it? Should he have given them a ticket or not? What leeway does he have? No, none of that. There's just the law, that's it. That other stuff doesn't exist. What do you mean it doesn't exist? We're telling you what he's doing. How does it not exist? It has to exist. Or it makes the law of ill effect because nobody knows how to enforce it. So then next week, we talked about doctors and nurses and whatnot. Teresa's late for work at the hospital, and she's going 150 because nobody's enforcing anything. And the law doesn't even matter because there's no way, no one has determined how we're going to enforce it. Does this make sense? When you get to a book like this, which there's these are the conversations. How do we go about doing this? Never, you know what, this, what we say, replaces the law. Can't replace the law, because what you're saying is trying to figure out how do we do the law. So then if you're saying it replaces the law, then what are you even talking about if there's no law? What are you even, what's the point of even discussing anything? What are you discussing? Nothing. There's no law. That makes sense? All right. With that, I want to read something to you here. And this is connected to Mishnah number 2. It says, Shimon the righteous, Shimon HaTzadik, was a Kohen Gadol after Ezra and served in that office for 40 years. During his tenure, many miracles occurred in the temple. Now, who is this Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the righteous? Do we see him in the Bible? Someone say, yeah. Where do we see him in the Bible?
The one who held Yeshua. Mm-hmm.
Who was the high priest? Who, you know, Hashem told him, you're going to, I'm basically making you a promise that before you die, you're going to see the Mashiach, the Messiah of Israel. So he's the high priest and he holds him. And he's there on Yom Shemini, the eighth day, to be there when he's given his name, when the Brit Milah is the circumcision. He's holding him, lifting him up. Wait a minute. There's no connection between the Bible and the Talmud. Yeah, they discussed all this stuff. Shimon HaTzadik was very schooled in understanding in the traditions and the what was written. How do we do it? You can find that in Talmud Yoma 39a. It lists many of the miracles that occurred in the temple during his time. Okay, so now you read that, and you see all the temples, all the miracles that occurred at the temple during his time of service. One, I mean, he held Messiah, right? Messiah was there, Messiah was given a name, and Messiah was circumcised. When you read this and you read about all the miracles that happened under his, is that adding something to the Bible?
Depth.
Huh?
Depth.
Depth, right. But yeah, it's just telling you what happened. You know, if you get the Fresno Bee about yesterday and we read what happened, they did an article about Emek Elohim, what we did last Shabbat. What is that doing? Is that adding to the Bible or anything? No, it's just, what is it doing? It's just giving the history of what happened. Same thing here. Yoma 39a gives you history of what was documented, the miracles that happened during the time of Shimon, the righteous, Simon, as he's called in the New Testament here. So let me keep on reading this. Each Yom Kippur in his service as Kohen Gadol, he would put his hands into the box and draw the lots for the goat that would be offered on the altar and inscribe for God, Adonai, always came up in his right hand. This is a sign of God's favor upon Israel. The scarlet ribbon was tied to the horns of the second goat, always turned white in the moment it was pushed over the brink of a desert cliff. This is a sign that God had forgiven his people sins over the past years. In accordance with the verse, even if your sins will be as scarlet, they will turn white as snow, Isaiah 1:18. La Donai, la Zazel, the other, the scapegoat. Number three, the lamp of the menorah, known as the Western lamp, burned for 24 hours, even though it was filled with enough oil only for 12 hours. The fire in the altar continued to burn strongly, even though the supply of wood placed there every morning was not replenished for the rest of the day. From each of the various grain and bread offerings, the omer, the two loaves, and the lechem hapanim, the bread of the presence, or if you want to translate that directly, hapanim, what is ha? The. What is pan? Face. What does im mean? Faces. So the bread of the faces of God. That's how you could, if you looked at directly translated from Hebrew. Each Kohen was able to satisfy his hunger with only a small portion. Employing his influence on Alexander the Great. Wait a minute. He had influence over Alexander the Great? Yeah. Shimon persuaded him to desist from conquering Eretz Israel, thus saving the land from persecution. Yoma 79a. You can read that in. And we know Alexander the Great went to the temple and he brought offerings to the temple, at the temple. When people say, oh, the temple of God was only for the Jews, no, it was always for everybody. But the Jews were there to lead it and service it for the benefit of everybody, all the nations. During the difficult time following the sudden death of Alexander the Great, Shimon HaTzadik was the uncontested leader of Israel, both spiritually and politically. High priest, Hos Messiah, there at his Brit Milah. And he was an uncontested leader in Israel, both spiritually and politically. You know, almost like a king-priest kind of a situation. Yeah, go ahead.
Where is it that it says that Simon held Yeshua?
And it's in the Gospels at Yeshua's circumcision. I don't have someone can find it for you. Yeah, I'll let you guys find it. Any other question? Do you remember I talked last year on Shemini Atzeret, the mystery of the eighth day? And we went through, I think it's Mark, but it's in Luke too. It's in the Gospels early in them. And we'll have a verse for you here soon. So we keep on going here. Go ahead.
Luke 2, 22 through
26, 7,
27. Yeah, 29. Yeah, Luke 2.
Luke 2. Luke 2, the whole Brit Milah of Yeshua. Any other questions or thoughts?
I think it's amazing that there is so much more to Simon the Righteous, Shimon, that we've never known. We see these little few verses about him and have no idea of the magnitude of who he was, what his place was in the community, in the whole nation, and what his impact was.
And how it even worked in Jewish society. You know, in the church, they would just teach, you know, okay, well, he was just this old man who was in the church or the synagogue, and he was given this promise. And, oh, my gosh, he got to hold Messiah, and he cried. He's, oh, thank you. Today, this miracle has been fulfilled, and that was it. And it talks about Anna. She was there serving in the temple from her youth, and she gets to see Messiah in the same day. That's it. We see this little pinprick of their life, and that's it. They had nothing else. No mention he was a high priest, and he was a high priest under unusual circumstances, because another high priest, if I remember the story right, Zechariah, was at the time of the service, just before Yom Kippur, was ceremonially unclean, so they had to call another high priest, or they couldn't perform the Yom Kippur service in the temple. So I think I taught on that. I don't remember, but I don't have all the particulars in front of me. But let's keep on going. Anybody, thoughts, comments? Let's keep on going here.
As one of the reevaluate people and situations, in all matters, one should act deliberately rather than in haste. The prophets equate the practice of monetary justice with knowledge of God. one who judges the case of the poor and destitute, that is good. For that is knowledge of me, the word of Hashem, Jeremiah 22:16. Hence, the Mishnah urges...
Well, you know, hang on one second, hang on one second. You know what? We're actually in the wrong... Is one of the remaining. Excuse me, guys, you know what? We're reading a book that's... It's written in English, but it's Hebrew style. So we're reading from...
Right to left.
Right to left. So we went backwards. So as one of the remaining... That's what we want right there.
Remaining sages of the Great Assembly... Shimon was the religious leader of the people, and because Alexander had decreed that the Kohen Gadol should be governor of the land, Shimon was also the political leader. With the power to enforce his authority, he used this power to strengthen the study and observance of the Torah throughout the land. Shimon ben Sirah, a poet, who lived close to the time of Shimon HaTzadik, composed a lengthy song describing Shimon in glowing terms. Among other things, the song says of Shimon, he was the greatest of his brothers, the splendor of his people. How glorious he was when he left the temple, as he departed from the Most Holy, like a star shining from among the clouds, like a full moon in the festival season.
You can read a lot about that if you want to in Ben Sirah, chapter 50. Any thoughts about that? No. Before we go on, I want to mention something to you. This idea, he was one of the remaining sages of the Great Assembly. You know, so he's around that Messiah. He's there as high priest. So we know he's probably, I would surmise, he's at least 35. We know that. He's probably older. He's probably 45, 50, 60, maybe older. I don't have any. It's probably available some information on him. I don't have it in front of me. He'd been around a long time, well respected, and he was one of the last ones alive. So the men of the Great Assembly, is basically the Sanhedrin.
Was he the last one? They always had a Sanhedrin.
He was one of the remaining sages of the Great Assembly, but they haven't. The Sanhedrin died off. It's ceased. Remember when? So. They did. And so what happened, you'll remember I've taught in the book of Yoma. I don't have the exact reference to it. I could find it. On the day when Messiah was crucified, a few things happened. There was a great earthquake. The veil of the temple split. The doors, which took hundreds of men to open, would no longer close. You know, the scapegoat... The lot for the scapegoat wouldn't come up in the right hand of the high priest. It never turned white. All of these things, but something people don't talk about a whole lot that happened is that the pillar of the entryway of the course of the Sanhedrin, this huge stone, it shattered. And so the meeting place of the Sanhedrin on the Temple Mount broke, no longer there. So they were forced to meet in the marketplace. They no longer had this great place on the Temple Mount to meet. And so because of that, eventually they just died off. Now, what replaced them? Well, we know we have the Jerusalem Council, in effect, replaced them temporarily with Paul and James and John and different ones who are part of that. But he was, it's saying he was one of the remaining sages of the Great Assembly, which started back the Anshei Knesset HaGadol way back at the time of Ezra, when they were coming back into the land and determining how to go about doing things. Go ahead, Case, and then I'll get to you, Judy.
that place where the stone shattered, is that a place where you can visit on the Temple Mount?
It's not there anymore. What's, yeah.
Is it like not there or is it like buried?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's not there and it's not visitable, if that's a word. Neither is Shlomo's colonnade that was on the Temple Mount too. Not there anymore. You know, where Yeshua walked during Hanukkah, not there. I know where it is or where it would have been. It's right, I believe if our memory serves, that was right above the edge of the Kotel, on the southern edge. You know, you go up, so you go, you're at the Kotel, you go up the bridge, and you come into the Temple Mount. On the right side is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. If you're looking straight ahead, it's the Garden of Gethsemane and the Mount. I'm going to say the wrong name here. You know, I'm talking about in the east, not Mount Moriah, but Mount. Looking east. No, but looking, we actually have the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is straight ahead on the other pass there. And you go left, and you turn to the left, and right what's there is the Dome of the Rock Mosque, okay? To the left of that, kind of roughly just before you get there to the left, at the edge of the Temple Mount, is where Shlomo's colonnade was.
Was meaning yeah. Like the structure just isn't there, or it's
beneath it? It's not there. I don't know.
Okay.
No, I think it was there, but it's no longer there because the Temple Mount, that part is original. That part was there as part of the base of the temple, that and the Wailing Wall. So yeah, some things are buried below and or no longer exist, and this is one of those that don't exist anymore. That was destroyed when the temple was destroyed and or during the time of the earthquake. So in a couple weeks, we're going to go on a temple tour together, and I'll bring my little temple thing and some pictures, and we'll go through the different areas in the temple. We'll be doing that soon. Yeah, go ahead.
I looked up on this one site, and it says Shimon Hazadik was Kohen Gadol for 40 years.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It talks about the rituals of Kiddush and Havdalah were introduced,
yeah.
And blessings were formulated over various kinds of food, and the reading of the Haftorah was added to the service on Shabbat.
See, there you go. Exactly. So a lot of the things we do today that are done in the synagogue today initiated then. And so if he was Kohen Gadol for 40 years, then that means he was at least 75. If I had a guess, he may have been 90 or 100.
He had to stop service at 55.
No, because you can't be a priest until you're 35. I don't have the particulars of his situation, but I can say that it was the situation that got him into the priesthood in the beginning was unusual circumstances. So, but look at that. So you're talking, so this is why this lends to the idea or understanding that he was one of the last remaining of the sages of the great, not just sages, but the sages of the great assembly. During times, so he was there for, he wouldn't have been there for the destruction of the temple, but he would have been there through the life of Messiah and the years, decades after Messiah was gone, he was still around. When Paul and when James and different ones had the Jerusalem Council and they were going out from there to minister outside of Israel. Right. But if he was, I need to look and see. Yeah, he could have been. But he was long enough to see. Yeah, he was long enough there to see Messiah and see. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yes. Yeah, so he would have been before Messiah's minute. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Exactly. But you see this idea of he was there. He held Messiah, and he wasn't the only one who knew of the miracle of Miriam from 10 months earlier.
Well, I just find it amazing with his relationship with Alexander and stuff. And Alexander
was not very nice. Well, so yeah, so look at that. So you can go back to Alexander and see when he reigned. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be good for you to look into, because you know how to do it. See, you have all the you put these timelines and stones, then you can figure some things out. Go ahead, Casey. We're going to stop for the day here.
Nothing to say, but now I do.
Oh, okay.
So, Alexander the Great, is that before? That's after Yeshua.
I'd have to look and see when he reigned.
Oh, before?
Yeah.
That seems a little...
We'd have to look at these timelines and see, and let the timelines tell us.
Because when I think of Alexander the Great, I think of something more, a lot more modern than...
No.
No?
He was way before Yeshua. It was like way before the Roman Empire. Yes. It was way before Julius Caesar.
332 B.C. to...
So, a few years ago. Who was Alexander the Great over, if not?
He was.
The whole world.
He right. No. Yeah. So that's a whole nother. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you guys enjoying this? So if you have the book, I would encourage you to read everything you can through Mishnah 1. Coming up to Mishnah 2, and we're going to bounce around a little bit because we have to get a better understanding to continue to move forward. So hold on to this, and then we'll get to that as well as we progress through. So Father, we thank you and praise you for this time we've had together studying the Mishnah, and we ask you to continue to bring us understanding today as we're about ready to start the service for the day. We thank you for your great love, great peace, and great help, oh God. We ask you to continue to stir us up, that we might continue to want to learn, oh God, that we want to change, Lord, that we wouldn't be offended about criticism, oh God, that would cause us to grow in you. So we thank you and praise you for that, Lord, in Yeshua's name. Amen and amen.